This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Joseph Calamia. Today is 10 July, 2008. I am in the Special Collections Library of Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Calamia is kind enough to join us from El Paso, Texas. Good afternoon, Mr. Calamia.
Good afternoon, Dr. Krager.
I really appreciate your taking time out of your very busy work day to chat with us here for a little while this afternoon. First off, let's get some biographical information on you. When were you born and where?
I was born April the 19th, 1947, El Paso, Texas.
What were your parents' names?
My father is Joseph A. for Albert Calamia. My mother was Geraldine, maiden name Campbell.
What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a criminal defense attorney here in El Paso for many years. My mother did everything from being a housewife to becoming a professional teacher of special ed. Is when she retired, she was teaching special education here in El Paso.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a half-brother and a half-sister from my father's second marriage, and I have a half-brother from my mother's second marriage. I was the only child from the original marriage.
Okay. How would you describe your childhood there in El Paso?
Up until the time of my parental divorce, I think I was seven at the time they divorced. My mother gained custody of me, and we moved to Los Alamos, New Mexico, where I resided with my cousins and aunt for a year or so. My mother remarried, and we came back to El Paso, and I lived at home with my mother and one of those storybook-type stepfathers.
Would you explain that to me, what you mean by that?
Somewhat abusive.
Okay. Now, what did you do as a young boy there in both El Paso and out of Los Alamos? What did you do to pass your time? Typical pursuits?
Probably got in a lot of trouble doing things I shouldn't have done. Actually, I was not a very good student. I quit high school. I should have graduated in 65, and I ended up quitting high school in 1966. I got a GED, at which time I then joined the U.S. Navy.
Now, you joined the Navy. Why the Navy?
My father had been in the Navy during World War II, the Aleutian campaigns, and for some reason I always thought that was a neat thing to do.
Now, how old were you when you joined the Navy?
I believe I was, I joined in 1966. I believe I was, 19 years old at the time I joined. I was on what they called at that time, I think it was called 120-day delay program, at which time they gave you something like 3 months or 120 days to get your things in order before you ship off to boot camp, and that's what I did.
What sort of things did you do in that 120
days? I'm sorry, sir?
What sort of things did you do in that 120 days?
The normal teenage things, see your girlfriend, tell them goodbye, you're going off to war, you're going to be a hero, and et cetera, et cetera. And hope for the best.
Sure. Now, you were 19 years old, and this is 1966, as you say. Were you aware of U.S. activity in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam in particular?
Oh, I think everybody my age was quite aware of it. Now, as far as political awareness, no, not really, other than communism was filtering into the South, and we had to stop communism wherever it rose. Now, anything past that, especially at that time, I would tell you I was quite ignorant.
Was this something growing up? Like you said, you quit high school, and you were of draft age. Did that have any bearing on your interest in joining the Navy rather than be drafted by the Army?
Yes, it did, actually. There are the two reasons. One was because my father was in the Navy, and that was a legitimate psychological need, if you will, because for some reason I always wanted to be on ships. That was a mistake to begin with, I guess. And the second was I knew that those on a ship probably stood a better chance of survival than those walking a rice paddy.
So did you think that you would probably be sent to Vietnam?
You know, I thought I might, but you always maintain that hope that you won't. I was not a gung-ho war hero type individual. I was, you know, like most kids, you know, if I go, I go, but I hope I don't.
Sure. Now, where did you go for your basic training?
San Diego, California.
San Diego. Now, when did you arrive in San Diego? Do you remember?
I want to say I left here in September of 1966 because Christmas of 66 was spent in boot camp. Mm-hmm. So maybe October of 66. In any event, it was near the end of 1966.
What was boot camp like for you?
Boot camp was a real awakening to me. I think I led a rather protected life here in El Paso. Didn't really have an inkling of what was really out there once you got away from home, your friends, and social support. It was a real awakening. I still think about it sometimes, even at my age at 61. I used to draw cartoons for some of the naval officers, and once started to try and think about drawing a cartoon skit with a cartoon character similar to Beetle Bailey, but it would have been based on naval boot camp. It was a real traumatic experience.
Is there anything in particular that made it so traumatic for you?
Learning to follow orders, I think. I had a lot of it reminded me of my stepfather. You know, you either do or you pay for it type thing. But once the first 3 months was over, the first 6 weeks was over, you started to acclimate. And during that acclimation period, the fear began to leave you, and there was a sense of or for me anyway, I speak for myself only, I guess, there was a sense of pride that started to callous over the other part of you.
Mm-hmm. What sort of training did you undergo here?
It was just a very basic naval training. We had all types of classes, nomenclature, naval nomenclature, Navy ranks, signs, things of that nature, shipboard activities. There was a ship stuck in the cement out there. I think they called it the USS Dry Dock at the time. Battle station practice, swimming, just the very basic.
Sure. Did you experience any difficulties with the physical parts of the training?
It was all difficult, but luckily I was physically, I was not ill, and I didn't have any real major serious physical problems prior to entering boot camp, so thank God I was able to go through it.
Now, while you're going through all of this, probably seemed like torture to you at the time, at age 19, was it around in your mind? Was this something you were thinking about a potential service in Vietnam and what they were preparing you for?
Yes, I think that was always a potential reality, like I said before. We'd go through it and we'd laugh about the training, but in the back of your mind you always thought, well, you know, what if? Because
mm-hmm.
at that point in time, I had no idea of what the Navy was doing in Vietnam. I had never even heard of the Riverine Force, which I ended up on. My idea of the Navy in Vietnam were destroyers and battle wagons hanging off the coastline, firing shells, for fire support, and maybe clandestine submarine activity. But other than that, that was about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when do you finish basic training there?
Finished in early part of 67. I can't exactly give you the date. Sorry.
No, that's fine.
After that, I was given an A school, shipfitter A school, which was welder, which was basically a pipe fitter and welder.
Is this something that you sought out, something that you wanted to do, or did the Navy decide that for you?
As you know, as I told you, I quit high school and got a GED before I went into the military. And I really had very little to offer the military, the government, or anybody else as a potential employer. And we took ASVAB tests and numerous battery of tests. And, of course, my scores, especially at that time, would have been quite low, I would assume. I ended up having three choices of what type of work I could do. And I wanted to go to sub-school, but the only way I could go to sub-school at that time, they told me I could be a cook on a submarine, and that just didn't sound macho enough for me. And I turned that down. I forgot what the second choice was, and then there was another choice of a welder or ship fitter, and I chose that because I thought that might be more macho-orientated, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Well, you go to A school. Now, where was A school?
It was also in San Diego.
Also in San Diego, okay.
Yes, sir.
What sort of things would you do in A school? What sort of training were you going through?
It was basic plate welding, arc welding, gas welding, pipe fitting. I really didn't like it. I guess I should have been I would have scored probably higher as a, I think maybe the other was a clerk or yeoman, and I think probably I would have done better at that now that I look back. But in any event, I really didn't like that type of work. I struggled at it, and if I'm not mistaken, quite truthfully, I think I was the anchor man in the class.
Now, I guess you would have undergone some sort of weapons training, probably in basic training, but was there any of this in A school as well?
No, not in A school. Basic training we had, I think we had the pleasure of one day on the firing range, and that was it.
They figured that was all you needed, huh?
I guess.
All right, well, you finish A school, I guess sometime, probably in the middle of 1967, would that be fair to say, probably?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Finished A school, then they gave me, I think, a week or two of leave to come back home. And from here, I was given orders. After that, I was given orders to Vietnam.
After you got back from your month or so leave?
Well, I had the orders for Vietnam before I left.
Okay.
Actually, to facilitate this, I brought some paperwork. I'm looking at an original order that Fairfield, California, to USS Garrett County, LST 786, and it's dated July 7th, 1967.
Okay, so you knew before you left that you were going to be assigned to the Garrett County?
Yes,
then.
Sir.
Okay.
Upon graduation from shipfitter A school, your orders were given to you, and I was the only one that got Vietnam orders from that class at that time.
Luck of the draw, I guess.
Well, you know, when you're the anchor man, you're a little more expendable.
Sure.
Be truthful. That's realism.
Yes. Well, now, we've talked about this before, and you said that the specter, I guess, of Vietnam was in the back of your mind as a 19-year-old, as a high school dropout, as a 19-year-old, and throughout basic training, you knew it could possibly happen. Well, here you go. You finished A school, and now it's going to become a reality. What's going through your mind here?
You know, I thank God I have never been diagnosed with cancer. However, I think it might be somewhat akin to a doctor saying, you know what, we found that you have cancer. We can work with it, but it's just hearing that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, it was, you know, it was quite shocking. And I tried to muster up the courage and pretend it was no big deal, but inside I was quite fearful, to be truthful with you.
Sure. Now, what was it that you knew about Vietnam the middle of 1967 that led to this kind of thing?
That it was heating up, and
okay.
That we were taking a lot more casualties. And that was about it. Again, I really didn't know much about. I knew nothing about this riverine force, and I didn't even know what an LST was.
Mm-hmm. What did you do in your last month of leave before you went over?
Well, I think it was only a week or two.
Okay.
I came home and saw friends and, you know, everybody wished me well, and that was about it.
All right. So were you, when you left California for Vietnam, I should ask you this, how did you get over there?
Well, you're right. I flew from here to, I think it was San Francisco, Clark Air Force Base, if I'm not mistaken. And from Clark Air Force Base, I flew off to Vietnam in a regular commercial jet.
Mm-hmm.
which I assumed had been rented out or what have you by the government. There was a lot of people traveling. We stopped in Hawaii for a few minutes, and from Hawaii we landed in what is it, Ho Chi Minh City, but previously Saigon.
In Saigon. So you didn't stop off in Japan or in Okinawa?
No, sir.
Just straight into Saigon, which would have been Tansanute, I assume, air base there. Well, Mr. Kalamea, you were 19 years old, maybe 20 years old by this time. You've been through training. You were trying to get used to the idea of being in the Navy in Vietnam, whatever that might have meant at the time to you, of course. And you are at Tansanute Airport or Air Base in Saigon. The doors open on the plane and you get out. What is the first thing that crosses your mind?
Okay. If I can answer that by reading something that I've already put down in my book, I think it might even be better if
please
you
do.
Don't mind.
Please do.
Okay, it says arrival. I arrived at the Saigon Airport on or about July 15, 1967, aboard a commercial airliner along with countless other sailors, soldiers, and Marines. The government obviously found it cheaper to subcontract commercial flyers rather than utilize total military transport for its troops. The plane touched down at about 2 or 3 a.m., to the best of my recollection. As I heard the wheels hit the runway and felt the jerk of the touchdown, I thought, quote, oh shit, it's real now, close quote. We all stood up slowly, too slow, and then grabbed our luggage and proceeded up the aisle to the front hatch of the aircraft. As I stepped out of the airliner, the first thing that shocked me was the heat and the humidity. It almost took my breath away. I froze momentarily on the portable platform leading to the tarmac and watched military flares floating down on parachutes. These flares lit up darkness all around the airport, and I was scared. Somehow, we were herded into a military bus and transported to our respective service embarkation points. The Navy personnel were dropped off in front of an old building surrounded by barbed wire and Army MPs encased in sandbag fortresses. The building was named the Annapolis Hotel. We even went through the motion of checking in with the desk clerk before we were assigned our beds. And I recall that the clerk was a very pretty girl who spoke good English. She told me her father had been French and her mother Vietnamese. Afterwards, we found our way to our bunks, and the flares, distant drumming of artillery, and pure fear kept me awake the first night in country. I think that pretty well. I wrote that a long time ago when I was putting this book together, and I think that pretty well remains the same feeling that I had.
Yes, that sums it up well. Sums it up not just for you, but for many, many other people who went through that same thing, I think. When you were on the flight over, and it's a question I should have asked previously.
I'm sorry, sir.
When you were on the flight over, and this is a question I should have asked previously, you're on this plane with many, many other sailors, Marines, soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
What are y'all talking about?
You know what? To my recollection, I think it was pretty quiet. I think we were all lost in our own thoughts. I'm sure I spoke with a few people. And in those days, you could smoke cigarettes, and I think we smoked insistently. Most of us smoked at that time. But overall, I remember it as being very quiet. Unlike when we were going to boot camp, I left from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to San Diego to boot camp. And on the train, it was, you know, there was a sense of shaving heads and laughing, playing cards and what have you, but it wasn't that way going on that airplane. It was completely different.
Like you mentioned, it was real when you got
it
off that
plane. It
was
real, right.
For sure. So you made your way down to the Annapolis Hotel. This place was somewhat infamous for a variety of different reasons. Could you could you describe the Annapolis to me, please?
To the best of my recollection, you know, it was barracks, quickly made barracks. It was surrounded by Constantine wire? If that's the correct term, barbed wire. There was Army military police with sandbags all around the hotel, if that's what you want to call it. And inside there were two or three stacks of wooden bunks, and that's where everybody was sleeping while they awaited to go to their different embarkation points. Sometimes it took, as a matter of fact, I think it took me about a week and a half, or maybe about a week and a half to get to my final destination. So it was a hub, if you will, for accumulating sailors going to different points.
Now, you were in Saigon. You mentioned you came in 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and you see the city that is so heavily fortified in a lot of ways, and the humidity, the heat, the overall strangeness, and I think it's probably fair to say the eerie glow of some of these flares that are around
right.
the city. What's going through your mind, young man from El Paso, Texas? What are you thinking when you're going through there?
I'm thinking, my God, I might get killed here. I'm scared.
It must have seemed very bizarre, I would think.
It truly was, but it was surreal, mm-hmm. basically, to me. Everything seemed surreal. The second night I was there, they gave me guard duty. And one of this guy gave me an M14, and he said, be careful, because before you got here last week, the VC came into town. There was shooting in the streets, and a couple came through the wire, and I shot a couple. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's all I needed to hear.
Sure.
So I remember walking around in the dark through the compound area and inside the area where everybody was asleep with this M14. And then there was some artillery fire that started, and then you could hear some rounds down the street, and you could hear the MPs yelling something. The flares went up again, and then I how it is when you get really scared. The hackles come up. Sometimes you break out into a sweat because it becomes very realistic. It's getting close to you.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw anything. I heard I heard some close rounds. I heard some artillery outside of Saigon, but it was enough to. Like a slap in the face, you know.
Now, you mentioned it took you about a week to find your unit, or to make your way out to your unit. Did you spend the entire time there in Saigon at the Annapolis, or were you going to different units on the way there?
You know what? If I recall, I spent 2 or 3 days in Saigon. One day they sent me out. They sent us out on work parties. And my second day, I think I was sent to... I know I was sent to the American Embassy building. It's the same one that the helicopters were lifting off the Vietnamese during as the VC moved in what was it, 1973, 75?
Mm-hmm.
It was that same building, and they put me on watch. And they gave me a 45 and put me out on a veranda and told me to watch some motorcycles. And
did they tell you why to look out for motorcycles?
Yes. The reason was because they had apparently had a lot of theft. And my instructions were, it's actually comical. If you see any Vietnamese walking to those motorcycles, yell down to the MP, tell the MP to hold them for you so you can go down and check their papers before allowing them to continue. I didn't know what papers I was supposed to look at to begin with, and those were my instructions. And while I was out on the veranda, a couple of girls came out, and we were talking and or laughing or whatever we were doing, and I saw a Vietnamese civilian, I don't know where he came from, I assume he was out of the building, but walking toward the motorbikes. So I followed through with my instructions, and I yelled down to the MP, MP, stop that man before so I can check his papers. And I don't know what type of language you, can I be truthful or?
Please.
Okay. We're all grown up here. His response was, fuck you. If you want him checked, check him yourself. I didn't know how to react to that type of response. I wasn't, I was told to do what I was told to do, and I assumed that we all were, in the same the same team. So rather than run down, I just watched this guy get on a motorbike and drive off. I wasn't going to start shooting a gun in the street.
Of course.
The guy who loaned me, who traded the pistol, another story. A week before I got there, he got in a running firefight with somebody who stole a motorcycle. Again, I don't know if that's true or not, but these things stick in your mind, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to be shooting this 45 down a busy street with a bunch of people in it. I'm not going to do that. So I just let this guy go, and it wasn't 5 minutes later that the master at arms was up threatening me with a court-martial and captain's mast and what have you if the bike was stolen. Apparently it wasn't stolen because I never went to captain's mast.
Well, your arrival at the airport was your first indication of how strange this was going to be. It seems to me that your time here at the Annapolis gave you a different idea of how strange it was going to be in a different way, it seems to me.
Well, you know what? There was a strangeness about it, but each area, or in my perception, had its own strangeness, its own aura, its own bubble of strangeness. The city was a different battleground, say, than the rice paddies or the river or what have you. And it was kind of, you know, the city was, of course, kind of dirty, and there was a stench to it. And if you don't mind, I'm in the process of reading this book called The Eagle Mutiny, wherein two young men hijacked a tramp steamer and took it to Cambodia. I'm sure you're aware of this. Anyway, this was in 1970, but I think they describe the smell here, and I'll just read this quick quick blurb from page 39. It says, everything was suffused with overwhelming smell of fresh fish oil, kerosene, urine, cheap perfume, tropical rain, lush vegetation, and garbage. And that's a pretty good description, I think. That's how the city kind of smelled. It was always busy with thousands, hundreds of motorcycles and scooters, and I kept looking for people throwing grenades at me, and all the horror stories that you had heard about previously.
In the midst of all this, what was your impression of the Vietnamese people at this early stage?
Well, I had no real impression, other than I thought that they were backward. Of course, now you have to remember, I'm a spoiled American, the ugly American, if you will, and I've had it pretty good in life. So although I live next to Juarez, Mexico, I've seen poverty before. I don't think I've seen it to this level. People defecating in the street, women squatting to urinate, things like that. You just it kind of throws you back into a primeval world, if you will, primordial world. But they were very nice to me. I had no real anger bent toward them.
Now, you had to eventually find your way out to the Garrett County.
Yes, sir.
How did you make your way out there? Did someone tell you, get on this bus, we're taking you out
yes,
there?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Explain that process to me.
Okay. Some of that's lost in my memory. I know that they said, for instance, it's time to go, pack up your sea bag. We'd be taken on a bus, and I remember going to a river or docking area where we caught a swift boat. And the swift boat took us across a large bay area up to another area where we met a small supply ship. And then we got on the supply ship, and the supply ship took us up river to there was three LSTs that were working in this task force. I think it was Task Force 116.
Yes, 116, the Game Warden.
Game Warden. And it was the USS Hunter Don County, the USS Garrett County, and the USS, I'm sorry, I can't think of it right now.
It started with an H, I can't think of it.
Yes, it did, Hunter Don. I just can't think of it right now.
Okay.
But in any event, I probably got it written down here, but in any event, that's how they got us up to the LSTs on this supply boat. Mm-hmm. Once a supply ship got there, I think it went every 2 weeks up the river, and once it got to the LST to unload for food, ammunition, and things like that, it was a working party, if you will, for the ship's company, and then we transferred and reported in and that type of thing.
Okay. Well, you finally made your way out there to the Garrett County. You know that you're going to be a ship fitter. You know that you're going to be welding as part of your duty, for sure. So when you see the boat, like you said before, you had no idea what an LST was when you first entered the Navy, and had no idea about this Navy rivering effort there in South Vietnam and in the Mekong Delta area. What are your impressions when you see this LST?
It looked like the Queen Mary sitting there to me.
Is that right?
As we came up on it, the ride on. Let me step back one. The ride up river, I think, took 2 days on this supply boat. We stopped somewhere, unloaded supplies, took on more supplies. I volunteered once to cover somebody's watch on the deck with an M60 machine gun, because this boat would go, I mean, it got so close to the jungle that sometimes the leaves and stuff would actually touch the hull of this thing. And then there were areas of the river that were extremely wide.
Mm-hmm.
So it took about 2 days to get up to the Garrett. And as we came up to the Garrett, I remember the water was brown, just like the Rio Grande River here, only there was a lot more of it. And the water was a little choppy when we arrived. And I just remember looking at this thing, looking up at it, and thinking, I need to go home. I can't stay here. I just can't stay here. That's the truth.
It must have been quite a change from what you were used to seeing in El Paso, for sure.
Yeah.
So you spent 2 days on the supply ship on your way to the Garrett County, like you say.
Yes.
Well, you finally reached the Garrett County. You're going to get off the supply ship, and you board your new home. What will be your home for the next year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'll ask this question. As a young 20-year-old man, what's going through your mind when you get on that ship?
My thought was I just can't. I don't think I can handle this. I need to go home. It was all so strange. It was like landing on the moon to me. And after a while, you know, you acclimate. You meet people. You talk. And you know, I think somebody sent me to get the bow door keys, which of course there is no such thing.
Exactly.
And like a good sailor, swab jockey I was, I ran to get them to take up to the captain, and became the focus of a lot of jokes, but I got used to it.
Were you the only one who came aboard the Garrett County for duty at this time?
You know what? I think there were two others. There was a black guy with me named Holmes, was his last name, ironically. And I saw him here in El Paso 30 years later. It was ironic, but...
Just coincidentally?
I'm sorry, sir?
Was it just a coincidence that you saw him?
Yes, he was a soccer coach. And I said, I know that guy. And we got to talking, and sure enough, it was the same guy that was on the Garrett County with me.
That's strange.
I think he left earlier, though. I think he had to go home on an emergency family problem, and he never came back. He left. I think he was there a couple of months, several months.
Describe the Garrett County for me.
Well, it was a World War II. They had refitted a World War II LST, number 786. It had gone for refitting, I understand. I think in the Philippines they had put air conditioning ducts in it and converted some of it for a helo deck, because we carry two helos helicopters at all times. The booms on the starboard and port side were hitching posts, if you will, for the PBR boats that we supported.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge, I think it was, I want to say, 320 feet long vessel, typical old-style ship, gray paint, rust spots, despite what the Navy might tell you. And it was sitting on this river, and it just sat there on an anchor chain until we were deployed to certain areas.
What was your initial duty there?
You know what? My initial duty there, they were short on, they were short on mess cooks.
Something you hope to avoid.
Exactly. I was an E3 when I got there, because once you come out of A school, you're automatically an E3. They should have kept me there 3 months in mess cooking, but they kept me almost six. So I'm a little bit bitter. I was bitter about that, because the work was, you know, very difficult, and the hours, etc. And I wasn't allowed to spend as much time in the ship fitter shop as I wanted to or should have until they had a lower class come in. I think the guys I was under were already third-class petty officers, E4s.
What sort of things were you doing here in the mess? What were your duties as the new guy?
Everything. They had you up in the kitchen. They had you in the scullery. I spent a lot of time in the scullery. Extremely hot, sweaty work. Cleaning the tables, loading and unloading food supplies, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. But eventually, this duty was passed on to someone more junior than you.
Yes, eventually.
And did
not
you go
quick enough for my liking?
Not.
Then I was glad I wasn't a cook on a submarine.
So then, did you go back to ship fitting, back in the machine shop?
Yes, sir. I went to the ship fitting shop, and I was again the low man on the totem. They had a lot more experienced welders and stuff there, pipe fitters, and it was kind of on the job training, you know. We had a lot of some of those jobs were not very exciting. We had SEAL team operations off the ship numerous times. We had South Vietnamese military in conjunction with CIA operations, and you know, which meant the ship had over 300 people on it, and you had to clean up stopped up toilets and things of that nature, and that wasn't too fun.
Sure. Well, you become part of Task Force 116, like we said before, the game wardens.
Uh-huh.
Tell me what the mission of the Garrett County was. What was your purpose for being there?
Okay. Personally, I was never advised what our specific mission was. I think it's just as you stay on the ship, you start understanding what's going on. We acted as a mobile home base for both Seawolf helicopter detachments. We supported PBR activities that were acting as basically police units, stopping sandpans, checking for arms, munitions, and things of that nature being smuggled. We also acted as a home base, as I said, for special operations groups and also for fire support for Army troops who were bogged down somewhere and needed assistance in fire support.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken, I did not work in CIC, although I had some friends that did, and I believe our call signal call name was Joe's favorite.
All right. You say you were there to support the PBRs.
Sorry, sir?
I'm sorry. You said that you were there to support the PBRs and their mission.
Yes.
Explain to me what supporting the PBRs meant. Okay. What sort of support did you provide?
Can I put you on hold just 1 minute, please?
Sure.
538-2217. The El Paso.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I thought maybe that was had another call. I thought it was I had to answer it. Anyway, I'm sorry if I broke the continuity of the interview.
No, no problem.
What was your last question?
You were describing to me the mission.
Yes.
Or how you're supporting the PBRs.
Okay. PBR support meant we acted as a home base. We fed them. We housed them. We worked on the boats if they were hit or damaged on the rivers. In the event there was activity further up the river, too far for the boats to go, then the ship would go up the river, pulling the PBRs or having them be ahead of us as though they were a scout unit, if you will, or maybe behind us, with, I would assume, helo cover when we did something like that.
Now, being part of a PBR crew, you'd have seen some very, very hairy things, I think.
Well, I was not, personally, I was not part of a PBR crew. I was ship's company.
Sure, sure. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
What I meant to say was that for these sailors who were on the PBRs, they saw some pretty intense action an awful lot of the time.
A lot of them did, yes. They were in firefights frequently.
Sure. Now, like you say, you're part of the ship's company.
I'm just a swab jock. Okay?
Sure.
But we made friends and befriended a lot of these PBR sailors. Some were from, in my case, some were from Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is only 30 miles up the road.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 weeks before I got to the boat, one of their PBRs was hit, and it killed everybody on it. The PBR was trying to check a sandpan that was, I guess if police terminology, was in hot pursuit of a sandpan down a river. And the VC had put up a Claymore mine up in the bushes, so as the PBR went close to the bush or underneath, they set it off. And it just destroyed everybody. I think the coxswain was able to get back to the Garrett County, but he died shortly thereafter. And the only reason I know this is because one of my friends on the Garrett was ordered to go clean up the boat afterwards, and he got there about 2 weeks before I did. So, other than that, I saw some with holes in them, but luckily none of the crews when I was there were shot or wounded.
Mm-hmm. So you established, it sounds like, a pretty good working rapport with the PBR crew.
Not much
animosity between the two.
They
groups.
Were fun guys.
Sure.
They would, give us rides sometimes, or you could put in a chit to go upriver. It had to be approved by the captain. I put in a chit, but by the time it was approved, I think I found out I was leaving in 3 days, and I decided I'll leave that excitement to someone else.
I think that's probably a pretty good decision. So you never got to go upriver with one of the PBR?
Not really.
What sort of things would they say to you when they came back in?
Well, they would tell us about, how scary it was when they stopped sandpans. They took a few small rounds over the bow. Sometimes one would hit the hull. One of them took a, if I'm not mistaken, one took a P-40 rocket through the main hull, but it didn't explode. It just ripped a big hole in it. So, again, as part of the support group, they would lift these PBRs up with the ship's boom and drop it down into the tank deck.
Mm-hmm.
And there those guys would fix it. They were made out of fiberglass, and
right.
They would have to work on these things with fiberglass and grinders. And those are the guys that I really felt sorry for. Those poor guys just worked their butts off, and they were inhaling all of that fiberglass constantly. It's just a nasty job.
About how many PBRs would the Garrett County support?
This is only a guess. I really don't know, but I want to say maybe 9, something of that nature.
Okay. Now, was the Garrett County ever called in to provide any sort of closer support rather than refitting and repairing? Were you involved in any actions upriver?
We fired over 2,000 rounds, 40-millimeter pom-pom guns. Hang on just a minute. Yes,
sir? No, that's no problem.
We fired over 2,000 rounds to support Army troops. We'd go up and down the river sometimes on firing missions, and we would fire on hooches, Vietnamese huts, etc. I guess they were getting intelligence indicating that they were supporting VC operations, and we were looking for secondary explosions. We can come back to that later if you want. What else? During Tet Offensive, we woke up and you looked out over the jungle, which wasn't too far away, and you saw a whole bunch of VC flags flying. Before, they weren't there. That was another shocker, because then you realize, hey, those jungles really do have enemy in them. And we were given orders to proceed to Vinh Long, because it was under full attack by BC and North Vietnamese forces. So we proceeded upriver, general quarters, all the guns loaded. The PBRs were going with us. And we came into the bay area of Vinh Long. The whole city was on fire. It looked like something to me out of Gone with the Wind, the movie Gone with the Wind, when Atlanta was burning, or You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, oh, absolutely.
Okay. That's what it reminded me of. And the ship turned around, dropped anchor, and we were going to fire the 40s, but we kept getting calls constantly, don't shoot here because you'll hit us, don't shoot here because you'll hit us, etc. And we never fired any rounds there. We acted as a hospital boat, taking on some casualties, a lot of civilians, a couple of nuns. As a matter of fact, I had a call from somebody in New York who's writing a book on the Sea Wolves who met these nuns and has them in his book. But in any event, just, you know, that we stayed there for, I want to say, a week maybe, 5 days in this one area, while this the battle actually probably lasted a day and a night. You could see tracers going up, tracers coming down. It was 4th of July, the real thing.
What was your role in all this while this is going on a bit long?
I was running coffee, food, to the people that they were bringing on, trying to help people come up and down the Jacob's Ladder. You know, nothing tremendous, just running here and there.
Mm-hmm. But you say that although you were there to provide whatever support you could, the Garrett County was unable to fire.
It was unable to fire, that's correct.
How does that make you feel, sitting in the middle of that and not being able to return fire?
We felt impotent. That's the only word I can come up with at this time. You're just totally impotent, you know, angry.
Mm-hmm.
And with good reason, you couldn't fire and hurt and kill your own troops, but it was just the idea. Now we have a chance to actually do something worthwhile, or as far as the war effort's concerned, really, and you can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was extremely frustrating.
What sort of impact did the Tet Offensive have on you, Mr. Calamia, in terms of your understanding of the war and its the way it was being conducted and what you knew about the conflict up to that point?
Well, you know, at that point, I realized that we didn't own the night, we didn't own the day, we didn't own anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those people still had control of the situation, maybe not for long periods of time, but they definitely were there, and they could weave in and out any time they wanted. It was frightening.
Did any of the PBRs that you were supporting at this time, how much action were they involved in?
They were going back and forth. Matter of fact, I have a really good picture in here that I took with a Polaroid camera off the helo deck of a PBR going into toward the city, and you can see, if you look, it was blown up to an 8x10, which of course it lost some clarity, but in the process you can still see some fires on the beach, and the boats are moving they're kicking up a rooster tail, and it's quite a neat picture, actually. But they were constantly weaving in and out, firing. They had twin 50s on the bow, and they had a single 50 port and starboard. Some had 50 on the fantail, and some were using M79 grenade launchers.
Mm-hmm.
It was a crank-type weapon, belt-fed, that was developed by Honeywell, if I'm not mistaken. And they were cranking those off. It was something to see.
You were there for, like you say, around 5 days.
I want to say 5 days, maybe four.
Mm-hmm. Well, when do you get your orders, to pull out of the Vinh Long area? Had the city been secured by that time?
You know what? All I can do is tell you I assume so, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Things had settled down.
Now, you're headed back down river, I assume, after this.
Yes, sir.
Probably
we
with
were,
the Cochin, I guess.
We operated on two rivers,
mm-hmm.
the Bossac.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cochin.
Cochin, yeah. You would have been on the Cochin at this time, I guess.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I don't know which one runs into Vinh Long.
Sure. I believe it's the Cochin, but
we'll
look at that later.
What we did, we'd switch rivers. Hunter Don, we switched with one of the other Garrett County, one of the other counties.
Mm-hmm.
And a week later, one of them got hit with a recoilless, and I understand it killed 18 sailors on it.
Wow.
So we were real lucky that they didn't hit us. We were in range almost constantly. Why we never got hit more or never took rounds, we took a few over some small arms going up the river during Tet, but why we never really got hit, I'll never know. Maybe they felt sorry for us stuck out there. I don't know.
Well, after your time there, Ben Long, as a result of the Tet offensive, you're headed back down river, hopefully to a more safe place, a more secure place. You had seen the real thing. You had seen combat out there. What was your reaction to it?
Well, you know, I think you have mixed reactions. I felt somewhat guilty because I couldn't participate, and I'm sitting there doing nothing while guys are getting shot at and wounded and killed. And then on the other hand, I think you're glad you're not, but, you know, you're even if you're helping people and whatever, it's just, you know, it doesn't seem as worthwhile at the time, especially when you're 20. I turned 21 in Vietnam, so I guess when you're 20, 21, you're thinking, oh, shit, I should be out there. Kind of a guilt feeling, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly a common response to that question. Well, once you received your orders and you're back down out of the river itself, I guess, what are your duties then? Were you called into for more and more support, more upriver support? What became of the Garrett County
Advocate? We were always on call to do support firing and what have you. Otherwise, we sat there. Ship's work commenced as normal. We landed. And, helicopters were coming in all the time. Flight quarters, and it was a, you know, we worked many hours. We worked our tails off, and every night you had a watch, or I did. And you were really tired. You were just walking zombies. You were in a zombie state for lack of sleep. Sleep deprivation was one of your bigger enemies, I think. Wore you down.
Well, take me through your typical duties here. You talk about these. How long of a day would you work, et cetera?
Can we do that tomorrow, Doctor? It's 1:30, and I've already got an attorney out here in the courtroom. I'm afraid I better get in there and do my bailiff duties.
Absolutely, we'll pick it up. This is Kelly Kreger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Joseph Calamia. Today is 11 July 2008. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Calamia is joining us from his office in El Paso, Texas. Good afternoon, Mr. Calamia.
Good afternoon, Dr. Kreger.
We were discussing the Tet Offensive toward the end of our interview yesterday. Why don't we pick up there? I have a few specific questions that I wanted to ask you concerning the Tet Offensive and your position and your experience, I should say, on the Garrett County. Now, of course, the Tet Offensive begins the end of January of 1968, and there you are, part of Task Force 116 on the LST in the Delta or plying the rivers of Conchian or the Bassac. How did you find out about this massive effort that was known as the Tet Offensive in your area? How were you notified?
Okay, as I believe I said earlier, I woke up in the morning, and from both sides of the shoreline, you could see Vietnamese flags flying.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really understand the impact of it where we were because we were not being overrun like a lot of the Marine bases and Army bases. But it was quite evident that there were a lot of people out in that jungle. Shortly thereafter, the ship went to general quarters, and I do not remember the exact term or words that the captain used, but to paraphrase it, it was something of the order, now hear this, general quarters, this is not a drill, man your general quarters station. So we're running to our general quarters station. I was in a damage control party, since I was a fireman, and up near the port side of the ship, up near the bow, and I was a phone talker, and relaying messages to the bridge, and in the process, I could hear some of the information being passed along, and then the captain came over the loudspeaker again and said, we will be proceeding to Vinh Long. The city is under attack. We are expecting to be fired upon. Stand by, be alert, and something of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, you realized it was no game, and it was, you know, you kept thinking of maybe something coming through that bulkhead, but we could hear the ship, the ship's screw start turning. You could hear, feel the ship vibrate, and we were proceeding upriver at a relatively good pace. I don't know how many knots we were going. And we proceeded into up to and into the harbor area of Ben Long.
Now, prior to the experience here during the Tet Offensive in 68, had the Garrett County plied its way up the up any of these rivers very far, in any great distance prior to this, or was this the deepest you've been on the river?
I'm sorry, I you know, at 19, 20 years old, 21 years old, you don't know where the hell you are. All you see is the river, and you know that the land changes. The shore either gets closer or further away. Since I was not privy to CIC communications, you just rode the ship. It was just, you know, you're there for the ride. But the ship did go up and down the river. It did. It was mobile constantly. You just never knew where you were going. I guess it depended on Seawolf needs, helicopter support, and things of that nature. And during, when I first arrived there in 67, we did lose one helo over the deck. And one of the sailors there who had befriended me was killed in that wreck. And they, his body was never recovered, along with the pilot. So that you did see some things that occurred, that, you know, even as a, just part of the ship's crew.
We went through the efforts of the Garrett County and the PBR and Seawolf helo support, like you said, yesterday in your discussion of the Tet Offensive there. Now, when it was finally over, when you were steaming back down towards the delta, I guess, or towards the mouth, what was, once the fighting was over, and you knew that it, that you were out of danger, at least for that that part. How did you assess what you had been through there?
You know,
what
that's
mean
a difficult
to you?
Question, because I think at that time you were just totally exhausted from being up long hours. The adrenaline running through, you know, even though nothing happened, you're still in a situation that causes your body to kick in more adrenaline than is normal. So, but when it's all over and done with, I think we were probably just looking any place, any time to find time to sleep and just get back to the normal routine. I don't remember exactly what initiated our return or when it stopped. I think, we were there about 4 or 5 days. It just slowly, basically petered out, and you have to remember we're on a ship on a river. We don't have access to communication other than our shipmates, so we really don't know what's going on the beach.
Okay, I was going to ask you that.
Yeah, it's amazing how departed you are from what's really going on. I had no idea of how intense Tet was until much later, actually.
Now, when you say much later, were you still in country at this time, or when you were home? Okay.
I was already back, and then all the information started coming in, Tet this and Tet that, and it was the Lunar New Year, and the VC had made a, with the assistance of North Vietnamese regulars, had made a concerted effort to retake South Vietnam. And you knew that, but you have to remember you're just a very small facet on this huge playing field, and you only see, there's only so much you can see. Your peripheral vision is totally gone. You're only looking straight ahead at where you're at the time.
Sure, and survival would depend on that too.
Yeah, and you just the rest is comes later as you get older or as you read. You know, it's just amazing how much you don't know what's going on around you. Maybe it's better that way.
Sure. Well, let's switch gears here and ask you about something that that I certainly wanted to get to in this interview, and that has to deal with the SEAL teams. I know the Garrett County was responsible for supporting SEAL teams before you were there and after, of course. What kind of relationship did you on the, like you say, the ship's company, on the Garrett County have with these SEAL teams, how would you support them?
Well, okay, the SEAL teams came, I'm trying to remember, maybe three times during my tenure. They would come aboard, and ship's company would, as I told you earlier, it would put a tremendous amount of extra work on ship's company, plumbing, feeding, you name it. Mm-hmm. It just added to it.
Well, how many of these, how many SEALs were there?
You know, I can't tell you. It varied anywhere from, I don't know, anywhere from 30 to 20, along with special Vietnamese units. They were all wearing tiger camo.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one night I was on watch. I went down into the tank deck, and from afar, the hatch opened, and out came a bunch of guys dressed in black pajamas with bandoleros across them and carrying guns. And just for a split second, I thought, oh, my God, the VC have taken the ship. And I just stood there. I had no gun. I wouldn't know what to do anyway. I just stood there, and then a few American SEALs came up behind them dressed in camos, and it was a special group that was going out that night that I didn't know of. I just apparently ran into them in the tank deck. They had apparently just arrived. And as funny as that seems, I remember that very clearly. I thought, oh, my God, the VC have taken over.
That would have woken you up, I would think.
I'm sorry, sir?
I think that would probably wake you up, I would think.
It most definitely did. Hang on just a minute. My
sure.
phone is acting up here. I'm sorry for that. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Now, the relationship, if you're talking about a working relationship, the Garrett County, and by the way, we were talking about the other LSTs yesterday. It was the Hunterdon and the Holmes County.
There you go. That's the one.
And I assume all three LSTs acted in the same capacity. But nonetheless, we acted as a feeding station, a birthing station, to fix things if they needed things fixed, and a place for them to clean their weapons and load up and hit the beach early in the morning. And sometimes, at one point, some of these teams had CIA operatives with them who were dressed as a civilian. I met two of them.
Did you just assume they were CIA, or did you?
No, you know what? I had no idea. As a matter of fact, I asked. One of them was carrying a World War II German Schmauser 9mm submachine gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognized that it was a World War II German machine gun, and I said, how come you're carrying that? And he said, I can carry whatever I want. And I said, well, you're not in the military? He says, well, I'm with the CIA. I said, oh, okay. Whatever you say. And he was very nice to me. He let me hold the machine gun, and he was wearing, if I recall, like a Y-Veta shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And jeans or some other kind of pants, but he definitely not military.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they were in charge of this specific operation, whatever it may have been. I do not know.
Now, when the SEAL teams would leave, would they leave on the PBRs, I assume, and the PBRs would insert them?
You know what? Sometimes they did, and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes a small group would leave on special stab boats, I think is what they called them.
Mm-hmm.
It's an acronym for something. It's something like a rubber dinghy with a special outboard motor.
Mm-hmm.
That would leave from the fantail, and it was almost totally silent. And a lot of the SEALs had special weaponry, such as the Stoner machine guns, and they carried other weapons of their choice. They would go hit the beach, do their thing, and then come back, and then they would have to feed them breakfast or whatever, and then they would sleep all day until their next mission or what have you. On one particular, if you want a specific incident, on one particular night, one of the SEALs came up to me. He was a huge man. He was overweight, but he must have been, I don't know, he looked huge to me, 6'4", 6'5". He was wearing black pajamas, the Viet Cong style dress, and he was carrying a Gurkha knife on his side. And he said, hey, boy. He says, what do you want me to bring you back from the beach? Something you can write home about and tell them you're a hero. And I said, well, could you please bring me back a VC flag? They said, well, I'll see what I can do. And then he came back, I don't know what time it was, and I think I was asleep in my rack, and he shook me awake, and he said, couldn't find you a flag, but maybe you'll want this. And he threw it on my rack, and it was a wallet. And when I opened up the wallet, I had a hard time opening it up because it was caked with congealed blood, just gobs of blood. And inside was a picture of a Vietnamese, his wife or girlfriend, and some other documents or paperwork. And, of course, I told him how nice it was to have that. I'd send it home, but I gave it away. That's not the kind of war trophy that I wanted to send home,
sure,
or even thought I could send home for that matter.
Well, when you see this, I mean, number one, just how bizarre this whole episode was, I would think, to you. When you open up this wallet, especially working your way through the congealed blood, and you open it up and you see pictures of a wife or a girlfriend or family, what kind of impact does that have on you, if any?
Well, you know what? It was a little bit shocking and a reality check. You realize that, you know, here's an enemy, or hopefully it was an enemy and not someone else. But regardless, the fact was these people had families and wives too, and whoever was in that picture would never see this person again. And it did stay with me. On another occasion, the SEAL teams took on a couple of prisoners, I remember. Two young ones and one older man. And there was, I never saw any waterboarding, but you did see some rough treatment. And they were trying to get some prisoners to talk. And as you know, torture and that type of thing is part of war.
Mm.
And they slapped this old man around. They put a hand grenade in his hand, and they pulled a pin, and they had an interpreter there with them, and they told him in no uncertain terms, if you release the pin on the hand grenade, you're going to blow yourself up. And then you dog down a hatch, you know, on a ship, you close it down. They stuck him in the back room of the fantail of the ship, and they left him there overnight under guard. And the next day they brought him out, and he was visibly shaking, of course. He'd been holding this spoon on this grenade. Now, whether the grenade was really live or not, I don't know. They put the pin back in, slap him a little bit more, and then ask him some questions, and he started talking, and they took him off somewhere to talk. They had two younger ones who were rough-looking guys who I would picture as probably real VC, and they took them up in helicopters. And of course, you hear, well, they never got there, because you know what they did? They kicked them out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they did that or not. I'm sure it happened. In this case, I don't know if it did or not. They could have flown them to another base for more debriefing, in quotes.
Right.
The older man later was still behind a roped-in section, and he had a SEAL guard with him who was guarding him. Young kid, real pumped-up type. And I kind of felt sorry for the guy in one way, you know, as a human being. He was sitting there, and I was smoking a cigarette, and I asked him if he, you know, motioned to him if he wanted a cigarette. And of course, he said yes, so I handed him a cigarette, and I stuck my hand over the roped-in area and lit it for him. And the SEAL turned to me, pointed his weapon at me, and said, you ever get near one of my fucking prisoners again, I'll blow your fucking head off. You understand? And I thought, oh, my God, he's serious. I said, yes, sir. He said, now get the fuck out of here. So anyway.
And what'd you do?
That was an experience.
I assume you left?
I left, yes. I think he was jacked up enough, he might have squeezed the trigger.
Wow.
Or at least beat the shit out of me.
Whatever became of this old man, do you know?
I have no idea. They later took him off. I don't know whatever happened. I don't know what the... I don't know where it came from. I don't know what type of operation. I don't know the men's names. I just remember the incidents.
Well, this takes us to a good point here in the interview, because I wanted to ask you about the VC. What were your perceptions of the enemy that they were facing there?
Well, you know, being on a ship, being in the Navy and ship's crew, you don't get that normally that close. Now, we had a few sandpans come up. We had a, as far as your question goes, I pictured them in black pajamas with hats, I guess like a VC, what they call it, sapper.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the term?
Yes.
Sapper. And that's how I pictured them. Of course, and you can smile and shake your hand today and cut your throat at night, just like they do in Iraq or actually any other war.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of a war zone, I guess. We had a no-shoot zone. I mean, we had a parameter, apparently, around the ship that I really wasn't aware of, but if a sandpan came too close, they would fire warning shots to say, you know, you're getting too close, get away. And I remember on one occasion, I saw part of it. The sandpan came too close to the boat. The officer was the executive officer at the time who had the watch. I don't remember his name. I just remember he was somewhat of a dork. Excuse that, but it's true. And
why do you say that?
Just he was an arrogant son of a bitch. He was just extremely arrogant. He was an officer, and you know, the Navy has a real class, or I assume it still does, a real class variation, even maybe more so than the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And he was extremely arrogant, and when this boat came too close, it was a fishing sandpan. He fired a couple of shots from an M16 over the bow, and the bullets ricocheted in the water, and the guy started raising his hands and yelling, I don't know, you know, I'm going, or whatever he was saying. That wasn't good enough for this guy. The sandpan was not coming toward the boat at this time. It was in retreat. He loaded an M79 grenade, and he fired it, and it hit next to the boat. And the shrapnel hit this kid on the boat and the old man or the fisherman, flipped him out and dropped him into the boat. We sent the LCVP out, picked him up, brought him back on deck. I came up later. I was on watch. I came up later, and they had already flown the kid off for medevac. He had received a lot of shrapnel wounds in the groin. The old man was still on the deck and had shrapnel all over his legs. It looked like somebody took a can opener and went up and down his legs, is what I remember. That's how I recall it. And somebody yelled and told me to go get the medic. So I ran downstairs. I ran down into the sick bay area, and I told the medic, there's a Vietnamese guy up there who got hit, and they want you up there to give him something for pain. He's in a lot of pain. And he said something to the effect, fuck the gook, I'll take my time getting there. And I said, well, I'm telling you, they want you there, and I ran back up. He finally got up there with his bag, and I don't know if he was simply afraid to try and do anything because he was inadequate, or he was just so prejudicial that he could care less. I really don't know. But it was upsetting the crew, because this old man had not done anything, and those who saw everything, you know, knew the situation. And they said, come on, Doc, give him a shot. He said, fuck him, I don't give a fuck. And at that time, I think the feeling was mutual. Everybody just kind of circled the corpsman or the doc and said, you will give him a fucking shot, or you're gonna go over the side in front of the officers and everybody else. Okay, all right. So he gave him something to kill the pain, and they flew the old man out to medevac him later, or shortly thereafter, too. One of the Sea Wolves took him off.
Mm-hmm. I would assume probably never be heard from again.
Oh, no, no. I don't know. I'm sure they took him to a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they would throw him out or anything like that. He was not a prisoner of war. He was just a wounded civilian.
Sure.
Or appeared to be. And that was something that stuck with me, too.
Did you see a lot of this kind of callous attitude toward Vietnamese, regardless of political affiliation?
You know what? No, not so much from the sailors. I think a lot of the Army guys were more hardcore. one of the problems that I saw or felt was that we stayed on station, I think, about 5 months straight or 6 months, without women, without booze, nothing. We had nothing. They wouldn't let us go on the... They finally let us go on the beach one time for a drinking party, and it turned out to be total chaos. So they brought us... They brought them back. But...
you say it was...
You know...
You said, excuse me, I'm sorry. You said that it was chaos out there. What happened out here on the beach?
Well, everybody, they got so drunk that they were just ridiculous, you know, fighting, and they sent the LCVP to pick them up and drag them back. They had to use a boom to pick up some of the guys. They couldn't even walk.
Wow.
These people were so uptight, and we had been so long with no recreation whatsoever, that there was a... say mutinous feeling about it, but you know, people started fighting on the ship. I remember one guy, as a matter of fact, the black man that I told you about that went on the ship with me, there was a boatswain's mate from the southern states who naturally didn't like blacks to begin with, and they got in some type of a fight about something. And he pulled out his hunting knife, and he was chasing this poor guy through the ship. And he ran into a shower, and this boatswain's mate said, "I'm going to kill that son of a bitch." And he brought the hunting blade down and just ripped the curtain right in half before they could pull this guy off. And somewhere or another, this black guy had secreted a pistol under his pillow. Because apparently there was bad blood between these two for some time, and this guy was in fear of his life. That didn't really get out too far. They kind of hushed it up. I don't even know if the officers became aware of that. But things like that, you know, it just started ballooning. And they finally sent us to the Philippines for refitting and some R&R, but it started to show its ugly face.
Wow. The pressures of combat are... Or being on station, as you say.
Being on station and, you know, watch. You'd work, oh shit, good 16 hours a day, or you know, you'd weld, go through ship's duties, serve your watch, get maybe if you were lucky, 4 hours sleep a night, five at the most if you were really lucky, and then start it all over again, you know, in horrendous heat, rain, whatever. And after a while, it began to tell on you.
Sure. I'm back before I led you astray there with a couple of
those. I'm sorry,
questions.
I didn't mean to.
No. I
wanted to get these stories into you so you knew some of the things that actually happened.
Oh,
there.
Please do. No, that was I'm the one who led you astray, I think, a little bit there. We were talking about the perception of Vietnamese, in particular the Vietnamese enemy. Now, you mentioned the treatment of this older Vietnamese man. And the younger man as well.
Right.
Now, you say that wasn't necessarily something you saw all that much of from the Navy. Maybe it's
right.
More so with the Army. Of course, the proximity, of course, with the Army.
Right.
You're dealing with them on a more daily basis, et cetera. What was your estimation of the abilities of the VC?
Well, you know, at the time when you first go there, you think... shit, no problem, we got it made, you know, we're going, you know, we have the biggest ship, we got the bigger guns, and blah, blah, blah. But when I saw those flags flying, that's when my whole perception changed, because, you know, again, you realize you don't control anything, they're controlling you.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to hit us, they could have hit us almost any time they wanted to. Or maybe our target wasn't that important to them, I don't know. But... You start to develop some respect for the enemy. Of course, the older you get and the more you realize what it took, the more you respect them. At the time, at that age, you know, I just realized that, you know, we're fighting an enemy who's a lot better than we were told.
Mm-hmm. What about the way they were conducting their operations, about their tactics, about their weapons? What
are you talking about the Americans?
About the VC, I'm sorry. About the VC.
Their superb guerrilla fighters. Okay. They were carrying on the war, especially there in the Mekong Delta, probably the only way they could, with the amount of supplies they were getting. But they're smuggling arms and munitions via Sanpan, just like they smuggle narcotics here in El Paso, you know, with cars.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the ongoing, these people were willing to steal the line from General Van Gap. He wrote a book called Whatever It Takes.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, whatever it took, they would do. And you have to respect that.
What sort of things about their abilities or their tactics in particular? I think that's a very good general assessment. But was there something in particular that you saw in your time on the LST, or that you heard about during your time on the LST that really shook you up or really produced a sense of respect for the VC?
No, not at that time, no, sir.
Okay.
Other than just what I have said or saw.
Mm-hmm.
If I would have seen something in a larger scale, perhaps I could comment on that, but I don't think I'd be qualified to really comment on that question.
Sure. Well, you were, to some degree, out there on the LST, a sitting duck. What sort of things did you...
Exactly.
What sort of things did you fear from the enemy?
Well, I'll have to give you this storyline, because we had an admiral come on the ship, and you said we were a sitting duck. Yes, we were, but this just epitomized it, and in an almost comical way. I was chosen as a side boy for the arrival of this admiral. I don't even know who the admiral was. I want to say it could have even been Zumwalt.
Wow.
Because he looked like, I remember seeing pictures later of Zumwalt. Very distinguished-looking individual. If I'm not mistaken, he had a lot of stars. It wasn't a one-star or two-star. This individual had a lot. And I don't know, perhaps your records can confirm what admiral it was that came aboard the Garrett County. But he came aboard on a hot summer day. And they lined us up, and they had these mahogany tables out on the flight deck. They brought them out after the helicopter landed, and they had these pitchers of water that looked like something in the courtroom here, you know, very, very posh. And the admiral was seated there, along with representatives of, ship's captain and the ship's XO and a few other people. And then it was somewhat of a show and tell. For instance, the representative of the Seawolf detachment came up, saluted Admiral so-and-so, this is so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. If you look, you'll see what the Seawolves do here on the river. And they'd have a couple of Seawolves come in and shoot the tree line by the river so he could see the action of what they did with the flex guns and the door gunners and et cetera. Then a representative would come up, salute from the PBR, so this is a PBR unit so-and-so, I'm Lieutenant so-and-so. Sir, for your convenience, if you'd look behind you, and then they'd have these PBRs parading down the river right next to the running parallel to the LST, shooting high rooster tails and machine gunning the tree line. And this went on for, an hour maybe. And those Navy personnel or the ship's personnel that were not necessarily needed for keeping the ship running were ordered to be out in full, to be out on parade and lined up on the ship. And the admiral was dressed in his white. Now, we were quite some distance from the shore, but we were not that far away that a recoilless rifle or a P-40 rocket or something of that nature could easily have been used and could have wiped out not just to mention a high head of naval command, but a lot of the ship's personnel. And as I stood there at parade rest, I thought, this is unbelievable. This is just unbelievable.
Was there anyone else who was sharing this thought with you? I'm sure you wouldn't have expressed that.
Oh,
that
no.
Time.
You know what? I didn't express it to anybody. You know, just I wish this hurry up so we could get back into our dungarees, that type of stuff.
It was bad enough when you were out there before. This just makes it worse,
I
think.
I mean, I'm not a military tactician by any means, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that, you know, Jesus Christ, they could have raised hell on that thing.
Now, you mentioned the recoilless and the P-40. What weapons did they have that of which you were aware bothered you the most out on the LST?
I guess I had heard horror stories about this recoilless rifle fire that did fire one round from the beach, do their damage, and then retreat into the jungle. And by the time you returned fire or got going, you know, it was too late. The chaos had already been committed. I can tell you that one other thing that sticks in my mind, as one time when the ship was going upriver, there were the remains of an old French gunboat, river gunboat, that had been sunk during the 50s there. And you could see the smokestack sticking out, and very top of the bridge, perhaps. And you could see large bullet holes and small bullet holes in the smokestack. And that had an effect on me, because I realized, well, if they could do it then, why can't they do it now?
Sure.
And sometimes they would dig holes into the side of the riverbank and cover it up with camouflage wood, and that's where they would set their traps. We blew up a couple of them like that were located but never used against us.
What did you use to blow them up with?
The 40s.
Okay.
We also had an 81-millimeter mortar or two that would placed on the deck. And sometimes as we would go up the river firing on hooches or firing for effect or for whatever reason, they would use this mortar with WP rounds and high-explosive rounds. One time we went upriver on a fire mission. This is another thing that sticks in my head. The ship went upriver. The 40s were being used to shoot hooches, and these hooches were quite some distance away. I'm pretty bad at distances, but I would tell you, I don't know, quarter mile, half a mile away, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little more, maybe a mile. But in any event, as we went upriver, the guys started, they ordered commence firing. And there was a water buffalo running across the rice paddy. So they shot it, I guess, so they could get their aim correct before they got into the houses. And I thought that kind of pissed me off, just to wantonly just kill something for the fun of killing it. And then I remember this guy came out of his house waving his arms. He was very small from the distance we were at. And they fired rounds into his house, and one went right into the door, and he just kind of vanished. And the house blew up in flames, and they kept yelling, "Yeah, we got secondary, we got secondary." So he was, I don't know if he was, obviously he was hiding munitions or something. And I remember that.
Well, let me ask about that for a second, if you don't mind.
Sure.
It could have been very, very easily interpreted, like you said, they fired on the water buffalo, killed the water buffalo to get their aim straight before they went in, and that angered you, that they would just, like you say, wantonly kill something like that. And to fire into a home, this could have been not a VC sympathizer. This home.
Oh yeah, sure. It could have easily been one, or it could have easily not been one. I supposedly, if I recall, they got intelligence from somewhere saying that these people were being sympathetic to the VC. Well, hell, all of South Vietnam was, if you want to know the truth. But the fact was, it was just one minute you're there and the next you're gone. There was one other incident where we were stationed on river, and a Phantom jet flew over the ship so close that the whole hull started shaking. And he dropped a bomb on some sandpans that were crossing the river way up ahead. The bomb looked like a black dot. That's how far away it was. But when it hit, There was about three or four sandpans on the river, and all you saw initially saw were tremendous shock waves going through the air.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next thing you saw was this huge gusher of water coming up, and then you got the report from the explosion. Now we did act as a rescue vehicle or ship. I was down below, but an Air Force jet was shot down by small arms fire, and the plane went up, started spiraling, and came down about a mile and a half, 2 miles down the river, and crashed in the jungle. They sent a LCVP recovery party over there, and they only recovered one of the pilots. The other had obviously been picked up by the VC that were hiding in the jungle. That was an unusual event, too.
It must have been incredibly conflicting for someone with like yourself, obviously with a conscience, a sense of what is right and wrong, to see the destruction that seems senseless in many cases, obviously, but sometimes this actually pays off.
Right.
In military terms, it pays off, which means it saves American lives. That must have been something, and this is incredibly leading what I'm saying here, so forgive me for it, but it must have been incredibly difficult to deal with the conflicting emotions of what you're seeing, what you're experiencing there.
That's been the trouble of my whole life, if you want to know the truth. Yeah, there's the yin and the yang. I know it's necessary sometimes. There were a couple of times that I was carrying a gun and could have shot somebody. Not that I went out looking for it or would have wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
I questioned myself many times. One time we thought we had a swimmer, and one of the guards had to turn on the light, and he said, here, Calamia, take the rifle. If you see somebody down there, shoot. I could have done that. I would have had to have lived with the after effects, and it would have bothered me. Truthfully speaking, it would have bothered me. But at the time, I could have done it because, you know, it would have been stopping somebody who potentially were going to hurt me and the people that I worked with and cared about there. There was a lot of atrocious things that went on in the war, a lot that I was not privy to, and a lot you need men in war who aren't so yin and yang or conscientious about their feelings. It's a dangerous animal when they come back to society, but at the time you need that type of person. And I guess that's, although I'd like to portray myself as that, I was not that type of a person.
Sure. Well, that takes us to a decent point in the interview.
Could you speak up?
Sure. I'm sorry. I think that takes us to a good point here in the interview, that we can look at some more general things, more general interpretations of the U.S. and Vietnam and your experiences in Vietnam. I'll ask you just a very broad question, and feel free to answer it however you see fit. What are your thoughts on why the United States was in Vietnam?
At that time, my only thought, a reason as to why the United States was involved in Vietnam was to save the good South Vietnamese people from the incursion of those bad, nasty communists coming over the border, similar to Korea when the North Koreans went over the 38th parallel. That was basically it. As I told you, I had no other real knowledge of Vietnam. I knew the French had been there. As I got older, probably like most veterans, I started questioning the validity of our incursion there to begin with.
Mm-hmm. In what ways?
To be truthful with you, I the more I think about it, I would probably have to tell you we probably didn't belong there to begin with. You know, if some of my history knowledge is correct now, the French after World War II went back into Vietnam as they did Cambodia, trying to reestablish their French rule, and by that time, of course, the idea of liberalism liberating the country, etc.,
mm-hmm.
had taken hold, and they had been fighting Japanese, and they weren't going to put up with the French or us for that matter. I really feel that we allowed the French, and I by by no means am I a lover of France. They've had some real good things with their culture, but you know, Vietnam was not one of them. But I think we didn't want to hear from the Vietnamese. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Ho Chi Minh even asked for our assistance to keep the French out. We turned him down and we went on the French side, probably knowing that the Vietnamese would eventually win their independence from France, but we wanted to watch it, hence, i.e., Dien Bình Phu. After they were beaten and they finally withdrew, all we did was fill in their shoes and start putting in more troops and more Americanism, if you will, to support one government against another.
Mm-hmm.
By no means am I pro-communist, and I hope you don't think that, or anybody that hears that. By no means am I pro-communist or pro-socialist. But in the process, South Vietnam really was part of the North long before that, and they were. And if I'm not mistaken, they also had won the elections, which I think we tinkered with.
Oh, the election in 1956?
Yes.
The U.S. wouldn't back the South Vietnamese participation in it, so they didn't exist in the South, as a matter of fact.
Okay. But things like that, as you start learning, you start questioning, you start questioning your government. You start saying, did they lie to me? You know, what were the real reasons? Well, probably some of the more realistic reasons, the more I think about it, was, number one, we wanted more warm water ports for our Navy. Number two, we wanted, rubber, other natural resources. I don't know what the oil is like down there, but if I'm not mistaken, they probably have oil as well. And it's a huge potential for making money, both legally and illegally, the narcotic trade. It's just so many things. And of course, I think the idea of stopping communism, we were so fearful of communism during the McCarthy period and throughout that it was kind of ingrained in my generation growing up. And I would still, if it were really to stop communism, okay, but I don't think that was the only reason. I think that was a ancillary reason, if you want to know the truth.
Well, what about the military aspects? Regardless of why the United States was there, what do you think about the way the United States approached this conflict militarily?
Well, at the lives of 58 some odd thousand human beings, good kids, good soldiers, good sailors, and so on, who were there thinking they were, you know, doing the right thing. We didn't fight the war as aggressively as we should have. First of all, there's no way that we could have beat their guerrilla tactics. The geographical area impeded fixed battles to the point that we couldn't do that. It was unrealistic. The next step would have been, which they did for a while, is to keep bombing Hanoi Trail and
Ho Chi Minh Trail.
I'm sorry, sir?
The Ho Chi Minh Trail?
Yes, I'm sorry. The Ho Chi Minh Trail, and also continuing to mine Haiphong Harbor and bombing Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
We were bringing them to their knees, and we would have won had we continued. But they wouldn't. It was making too much money back here to quit the war, I think. Industry was great back here in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when the war quit and petered out, when you got out of the service, there were no jobs. But militarily, they should have gone in for the larger game, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Shipping, industry, that type of thing.
Sure. All right. Well, when do you leave Vietnam?
I left the ship. Let me see. I have that here. I left a week or two early. They signed me out off the ship on 15 July 1968. They had me arriving on the ship at 2 August 67. I left a week or so early because the helicopter came in and they told me to get on it, so I did.
It was a good time for that, I guess. Where did you go there after that?
Tonsonut.
Okay.
And from there I flew back California, and from California I flew home.
What were your thoughts on leaving Vietnam when you did?
You know what, I was scared, I was thrilled, and I also felt somewhat guilty.
Why do you say you were scared?
Well, scared because, for instance, on the flight back, two reasons. One was psychological, the other physical. On the flight back, the helicopter was shot at, and you could hear these bullets breaking the sound barrier as they popped and went by the rotor blades.
Mm-hmm.
And the gunner, we said, "Hey, something's wrong with your engine." And he laughed and said, "Hey, asshole, they're shooting at us. You better sit on your helmet." Well, that was an awakener, too.
Mm-hmm.
And then psychologically fearful because it's like being in a prison. And as a federal probation officer, parole officer, and prior federal probation and parole officer and pretrial officer, I've been to some prisons, and it's quite similar in that circumstance. You're on a ship, you're extracted from society, you're only with several people, and when you get back into a lot of people moving around you, you don't know how to act. I found the only psychological problem I had that I recall coming back was I would shake sometimes when I was in a crowd or when I would go up to pay for something I purchased at the 7-Eleven, or if people would gather around me, I found myself shaking. Some type of anxiety attack for some reason. And that eventually subsided, and I no longer have that.
How long do you think it took before it subsided?
No, it was probably about 3 years.
Really? You also mentioned that you felt a sense of guilt upon leaving. Could you explain that to me?
Sure, because I was coming home and those guys were still stuck there. You know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. Ha ha, I'm going home, but, you know, it's not right. We should all be going home, you know, something of that nature.
Mm-hmm. What did you hope to do when you got back? What were you going to do with your life, as it were?
Well, I still had two more years in the Navy. I ended up being transferred later to the USS Concord, pre-commissioning duty in San Diego. While I was there, I ended up getting married, and then they transferred the ship to Norfolk, Virginia. My wife flew there to meet me. We lived in a shack there in Norfolk. She got pregnant, had a child, and I was transferred to the USS Amphion, which was a tender.
Mm-hmm.
That was better duty, although they worked me to death. The fact was it hardly ever went anywhere. So I ended up my Navy career there in Norfolk, Virginia. I was discharged on November 21st or 22nd, 1970.
What did you choose to do next?
My wife at that time, I'm divorced now, but from her. We moved to Fort Worth, Texas, where her family was. I tried to find a job, couldn't find anything, and I ended up finding a job working at a gravel pit, throwing rocks off of a conveyor belt, and eventually worked into driving heavy equipment for a couple of years. Came back to El Paso, worked construction here as well. Then in 1973, I had applied earlier. I got a job as a clerk with the FBI here in El Paso, and stayed with them 6.5 years, and while I was with them, I started college, got my degree. I left the Bureau in 79, transferred to U.S. Probation and Parole, stayed with them for 10 years till 1989. There was a schism or split in the department to what they call U.S. Pretrial Services, and I went with them and was there with them for 14 years. It was still under the auspices of the United States federal court system.
Mm-hmm.
I was a probation parole officer - pretrial officer. We carried weapons, but we didn't make arrests. We carried weapons more for self-protection. Worked as a firearms instructor with them part-time. They sent me to firearms school, what have you. Then I retired in 2004. At 57, the federal government makes you retire if you're carrying a gun. And stayed home for about 3 months. Had to do something. Had applied here as a part-time bailiff, which I had never done that type of work before. They started calling me to work as a bailiff, and I started working here as a bailiff part-time for about 2 years. Some of it got slim. They wouldn't call anymore for a while because of cutbacks. I found a job working at a funeral home for about 6 months and then came back here. And then about 2 years ago, 2 years in August, I have been with this court on a full-time basis.
When you came back home in 1968...
1970. Oh, you mean from Vietnam?
Yes, from Vietnam in 1968. And this goes all the way through 1970, of course, because the war is obviously still going on as well. What were your impressions of the anti-war movement in the United States? As someone who had participated and had seen what you had seen, what was your impression of these people who were so vehemently against the United States being involved in this conflict?
It angered me. I was very angry with them for doing that. You don't have to agree with your government's. You don't necessarily agree with your government's actions. Matter of fact, if you're just a yes sir man all the time, then you might as well be a robot. But the fact is, when you're under military jurisdiction and you're in the military, you do what you say. You do what you have to do. You know, you're committed, and it's your duty. I felt it was, it was a duty. I didn't like it. I have to be truthful with you. I was very self-centered. I was extremely angry that I was over there for some time while others were over here doing nothing or rioting or running around with peace signs. Now, the free love movement and some of the go-go girls and the blinking lights, oh, that was okay.
A man has to pick and choose.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You got to take a little from each thing. But as far as the actual revolutionary or revolutionist idea and the Che Guevara flags and later on when I was with the FBI, it was the SLA, Sibonese Liberation Army Group, those, they angered me. And it frustrated me, and it took me a long time to, forgive those people. I really don't hold any grudges against them. They, if they were truly believing what they did what they had to do. But at the time, I was very angry.
If you can give me just a broad impression, what were your thoughts on your overall participation in the Vietnam War? Either at the time or since then.
Okay. My overall thoughts of my personal participation were that as I stayed there longer, it was not enough. I felt that I had only, kind of on the outside looking in type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps I should have been engaged in I was more of a non-combatant, actually. And there were so many that were in actual combat, so you feel somewhat, again, the term guilty, How would I have acted had I been in a real firefight? How would I have acted had I seen some of the horrible things that the other people had to see or live through? Perhaps I wouldn't be so philosophical as I am today.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps I would have been in a mental hospital. Who knows? A lot of times working in the federal legal system, I saw a lot of them come back that entered the system for drugs. They got hooked on heroin. They got hooked on grass. It changed their whole life. It destroyed a lot of people, not just from arms, but psychologically. And I was somewhat angry that the government didn't help reinitiate or debrief these people when they came back into society, as what I see happening now with these kids coming back from Iraq and stuff. We're already starting to see a lot come through the system. You know, DWI, drunk driving, shooting up houses, you know, it's having an effect. And I particularly feel that the kids today probably even have it worse than we did in Vietnam, because they're having to serve so many tours of duty because there's not enough men. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it certainly does. Unfortunately,
I get very angry when I see young women in military, in combat. If they want to do that, that's fine. That's not my reason for anger. I salute them, and I give them all the kudos in the world. Those are real human beings. What angers me is the fact that this country allows this. It's okay for the girls to go join you guys and get your ass shot off and blown and maimed, while the rest of the country, again, back to this Vietnam thing, sit here and worry about who's going to be the next teenage idol or dancing idol or American idol.
Sure.
On TV. And to me, I'm sorry, it shows a real flaw in this country.
So that
my father's generation was definitely the best generation.
Well, Tom Brokaw certainly thought so.
Yes, sir.
Not to write a book anyway. Well, I think you've given me a pretty good idea on what you came away from this with and what this meant.
It made me grow up. It made me question my own mortality, of course. Mm-hmm. It also made me realize that I wasn't the only guy around. You know, I wasn't as important as I thought. I wasn't so clever. I realized that I wasn't so tough at all, with a hell of a lot of people out there that are really tough. And it made me realize that that war is a nasty reality, but it's a necessary one, I'm afraid. I don't think that the world was set up where you will, as the Beatles, live in peace and above you there's only sky, etc. I think that's a fantasy. Now, if we can reduce it, that's fine, but overall, there will always be wars, and there will always be unfairness, but hopefully there'll always be enough good people involved who carry on afterwards to maintain some stability in this world.
Sure. Very well put. One last question I have for you here. You've given me a very good idea of what the war meant to you personally. What do you think the war means to this country? When someone says, what was the Vietnam War about for the United States, what comes to mind for you? The legacy of the war.
Well, what was it about? I don't think we know. It was about a lot of things to a lot of people. I don't think there's one specific answer, other than the fact, if you want to throw up the old to stop communism. And we probably helped in some way bring down the capitulation of the former Soviet Union, because they were pumping in so many arms and stuff. That must have cost them a good penny during those times as well. In some small way, perhaps we did help bring down communism, but again, to what end, you know?
Well, do you have anything else you'd like to add, Mr. Calamia?
No, not that I can think of. I really appreciate your time and interest in taking your time to even ask me questions like this. It's I enjoy talking about it. Because it shows that somebody's still interested out there, not so much, you know, about me personally, but the thoughts, the things that went on, how the war was for me as compared to somebody else who had it much worse. And believe me, I know I was very lucky. And then some of the other Navy guys were much luckier, because they floated off the coast and fired on a few rounds and then went off and went to the Philippines or to Australia, you know.
Right.
But I wouldn't trade the experience for $1 million. But I wouldn't want to have to relive it.
Sure. I understand. Well, that'll put the end to this interview then. I really appreciate you taking your time. I will ask you to hold on after I wrap up the interview. We'll chat for a moment, all right? This
okay.
will be the interview with Mr. Joseph Calamia.